This episode of the Daily Brief podcast is brought to you by 2C Creative, an award-winning agency that crushes it on everything from 360 integrations to live action, design, trailers, and editorial.
Hello, I'm Laferne Cusack, senior producer here at Promax BDA, and this is the Daily Brief podcast. You have to keep going and you will survive, says Sean Awolo, partner and executive producer at Big Machine. Just choose to keep going. After investing a decade in the music business, Sean saw Napster coming and decided on a new career in television marketing. His success, though, was not immediate. From ill-fated gigs during the dot-com boom to having to return to music, his path is everything but traditional. Kareem Taylor sat down with Sean to hear his story in his own words. He talks his numerous business of music conversations with Sean Combs at Howard University, to finding his first TV gig through a job posting, to winning an Emmy at Big Machine. Listen in as Sean describes how he lives by his motto, taken from what his uncle would say to him growing up, which sounded very similar to what my Jamaican mother would use to put some pep in my step. She'd say, "Lord, girl, what you gonna do? Lay down there and die? Get your butt up and figure it out." But I digress. Here's Sean and Kareem.
I'm sitting here with Sean Awolo, partner executive producer here at Big Machine. How'd you get from Howard University to being a partner and executive producer at one of LA's top agencies?
Yeah, it was. It's been an interesting journey, and along the way, it's entailed a not so short journey through the music industry, obviously through television production. But you know, at the end, I think the answer is just perseverance and a willingness to recreate myself when the time called for it. You know, Howard was interesting because I always thought, and I was just talking to someone about this the other day, I thought I was going to go onto Wall Street. I when I was at Howard, I was very much suit and tie, school of business, marketing degree. You know, I grew up in Connecticut, so it's interesting when you're from the West Coast, right? You have Hollywood as your backdrop, and so that could be a possibility for you. When you grow up in Connecticut, it's really Wall Street. It's seeing your friends' dads on the train commuting to New York to make the money to come back to Connecticut, and so that's the dream, right? For a young African American, that's the influence in terms of what you think, where you think the money's at. You're like, it's all these guys that you see getting on the train at 8 a.m. in the morning with their briefcases. So that was my mindset. Along the way, Sean Diddy Combs happened, and you know, here comes this really cool kid at Howard that I see on the yard all the time, that I was able to strike up conversations with, and I knew he was interning at Uptown at the time, and some people thought that was weird, that he was, you know, sneaking away from school in the middle of the week to go back to New York to do this internship. Well, after a while, you know, he's got his own story, so we need to really reiterate that. But when he left Howard and took a full-time job at Uptown, I remember just being like, "Hey, dude, so there's real money in music," and he told me what he was making at the time, and it wasn't particularly a big amount, but for a kid at college with no money, scraping your pennies together to buy a two-piece at Church's Chicken, it was a lot of money. Yeah, so all of a sudden I was like, "So you can dress not in a suit and tie and make that type of money, and you can sort of be who you are and your own personality." I was like, "I think I gotta see what this music industry thing is about." So, you know, I stayed in touch with him, networked with a couple of other folks, and just ended up doing a string of internships before going into the industry as a full time music employee, which led me from Washington, D.C. and Howard to New York City, where I had a real great stretch in the music industry. Got to work with a lot of great acts, and some real iconic executives, some real iconic execs out there, from guys like Steve Stout, and it's really nice because I got to work with people that are, to some degree, have had a lot of success now. But it was interesting to see them grow. Like, it was interesting to see Sean Combs continue to grow to the empire that he has now. Along the way, I ended up working for a record label called Ola Records, and that was probably one of the real heights for me, because it was run by Jelly Bean Benitez, and I was a huge Madonna fan growing up, amongst other artists that I really liked. And so he discovered her, that was her first daughter's godfather. And so it was really interesting to work with this guy and be in his office, and he's got all these great stories. But it was also really nice because he was trying to build a label that was Latino influenced, but had a presence in urban music. And I got to run his whole presence in urban music. And so it was like a lot of freedom. It was the first time that I had a lot of freedom to sort of do what I wanted, and things were going to be successful with me or they were going to fail with me. But that's always kind of the position that you want to put yourself in. You always want to put yourself. Some people are afraid of having it be on their shoulders. But to me, that's what you want, because your greatest failures are going to come from that, but your greatest successes are going to come from that too. And so, yeah, there were some failures. But there were a lot of successes that happened there, and it was pretty awesome to be a part of it, and it was really great to have at that point in time people like Sean Combs and other people that I admired who were like, okay, we see what you're doing, and they see that you're sort of making your own path and cutting your way. So that was a highlight. It's interesting when I had the failures. Especially at that label, was sort of coinciding with what the music industry was going through in general. So when the failure started happening, it was also sort of around the time when the internet was starting to grow and be certainly not what it was is today, but some level of presence. And there were murmurings of, listen, we have to protect our music online, which a lot of people thought this internet thing is never going to be humongous. I mean, what are you talking about? We don't need to pay attention to that, which is funny if you think about that now. So, you know, I stayed in the music game for a bit. And then when Napster happened, I kind of saw the writing on the wall. And I started seeing people losing their jobs. And it just felt like, maybe I got to start thinking beyond music. So reinvention number one was that there were some things going on in my personal life with my family. And I had just had my first daughter. And I realized that there was an opportunity to move to California, to move to the Bay Area. And I thought it would be a real good change for my family and a real good change to get my young daughter at the time, who was, you know, two or three, out of New York City, because we were starting to have issues like I'm pushing a stroller on the crowded, dirty subway in New York with a bunch of people that, you know, please don't touch my daughter. You look like you're filthy and crazy, you know? And I was like, I don't know that this is the best place to, you know, raise a child unless you are really, really wealthy and can, you know, not be a part of just being a regular individual, you know? So, and my hat's off to my friends that actually are still in New York and raising kids, because I was like, I don't know how you do it. But yeah, I took my family to the Bay, and I put two and two together and was looking at sort of why I'm there. And Napster certainly was a reason that I got out of the music industry. And I was like, I think there might be something in this internet thing. So I spent 2 years working for internet startups, and that also was a real interesting and awesome learning experience, because the first company I worked for, eTour.com, had, I think I was employee number 12. 28 or 29. I was pretty early on in the company with a bunch of stock, and I kind of thought, oh, this is great. You know, if this thing gets big and goes public, like all these companies are going public, I'm going to be rich. This has been the easiest, you know, transition ever. Like a lot of people with that story, I discovered real quickly that the guys at the top who had gotten all this money that I thought were really smart young kids from Wharton Business School, well, maybe they weren't so smart, and I know, and who knows how they got, you know, $20 million in funding, but their business plan really wasn't good, you know, and so very shortly, we ran out of money, and people started losing their jobs until the infamous day, like most dot-coms in the early days, when they come in and go, we have no more money, everyone's gone, you know. But I was fortunate enough to be good enough at my job, I guess, or be well enough off the radar, maybe, that that I was there on the final day. I was there on the day that every, you know, there'd been plenty of cuts, so you sort of knew the writing was on the wall. But and I took a job right after that with another dot-com. But now, because I had been through that experience, I went to a company where a lot of people hadn't had that experience, and so they were sort of still in the blissful stage of this is awesome, and we're building a utopia. And I was like, I don't know if this is going to last, you know, so I'm going to go into this with the mindset of like, this probably isn't going to last. And sure enough, you know, sort of the same mistakes are being made there. You know, I always tell people this funny story of like, when I first got there, the kitchen was immaculate, and they had this huge freezer, and it had every drink possible and fully stocked with beer. And over a 2-year period, you'd start to slowly see like, oh, there's no more beer being stocked in there, you know, and there's no more like, you know, vitamin water. And now there's just regular water. Well, now it's not even like expensive water. It's just like the generic brand from. And so you sort of know like, yep, the time is coming. So I had made up my mind as that process was going that I was going to give one more shot to the music industry. And I had a friend who I had signed his first deal when I was in New York City as a producer by the name of Mike City, and he's one of my best friends. And he had come into his own here in L.A. With producing a song for a bad boy artist, Carl Thomas, called I Wish, which is a major gold hit. And then he had signed his own artist, which is a girl that I also knew and had tried to sign in my New York days and was unsuccessful, called Sunshine Anderson. And she did a hit, Heard It All Before, which was a monster in music industry terms. And so I was coming down from the Bay more often just to hang out with him socially and sort of enjoy the Hollywood lifestyle of a hit music producer. You know, he had a penthouse in Beverly Hills, and we would go out and eat at expensive restaurants and just have a good time. And so he suggested, hey, if you're done with that internet thing, you should just move down here and you know, let's do something in music together. Like help me run my production company. So I took him up on it. And it was great. I came down and we were sort of off to the races and executive producing tracks for everyone from Sunshine to Brandy to Jamie Foxx. But it was evident at that point that the music industry had really changed, and it would never be, to me, what it was, what it had been. There were still people getting fired. The jobs just weren't replenishing themselves as quickly as they had in the past. And so I just felt it's a different day. And the monster's out of the gate with the internet, and if people can get songs for free, they are not going to pay for them, and it's just not going to, it's not coming back to those days. And so I just didn't really have an interest in staying in that. And part of it is I couldn't figure out what the magic formula was to allow you to make the type of money you used to be able to make. And there are people out there, and you know, I'm proud to call some of them friends, who have figured it out, you know, and so God bless them, because they had a vision that I couldn't see that. So I started thinking, let me reinvent myself again. And the next reinvention was, I have all this experience in music, and I have this experience of working with venture capitalists and working with some bright minds in the internet for a couple of years. So what do I want to do? And as I looked at what was going on in LA, I just decided, you know, let me try television. Let me try TV and see, you know, how that looks, you know, and didn't really have a game plan. It was kind of the first time that I didn't have this really solid game plan. I was like, let me just see what I can get in television. Let me see where I fall. Let me see where my skill set works best. So I was on a entertainment jobs website and saw a posting for a business development rep at a company called Three Ring Circus. And so I went into the interview, and it was really this interesting sort of barrage of questions by fire from the owner, John Sideropoulos, and his creative director and his producer. And I tried to answer all the questions the best I could. And at the end of the day, I said, hey, guys, you know what? I love what you guys are doing. You have all these awesome graphics that you're creating and these show packages. And I don't know your business 100%, but I know that I love animation. I love design. I've always been a fan of it. And so it'd be great to sort of have a trial by fire. And why don't we make a deal? You know, I'll come in here for 6 months. And either you guys will like me and I'll like you, or we won't like each other and we just call it a day. And that's probably, you know, not the worst liability that you'll ever have. And so John Sideropoulos, thank goodness, to his credit, thought that was probably pretty bold of me to say, and he gave me a shot. And then the rest is sort of ignorance on fire. You know, I didn't know what I didn't know. So some of the things I didn't know is that Three Ring had been a real big company, what we sort of call a legacy company, back in the days of Pittard Sullivan, you know, where they were sort of the big dog, and then they splintered off, and Three Ring was one of the companies that splintered off from them. And they had done a ton of big projects, from the motion design and Minority Report to huge commercial huge commercial projects. And then the company had splintered apart, and one of the main creatives, Elaine Cantwell, had left to start her own thing. Jeff Bortz had left to start his own company. And John had retained the name Three Ring Circus, but not necessarily the huge client base, because that sort of splintered when all the separate, you know, personalities went their separate ways to start their separate companies. But I didn't know any of that. So I just came in there and started calling people, cold calling people, and introducing myself and going, you know, hey, I'm at Three Ring and they're super cool, and let me send you a reel and look at this that we're doing and look at what we could do for you. And I think people were caught off guard. I think people were really, they were like, who is this kid calling me? Does he not know what happened at this company? You know, and they just were curious. And I think it was enough curiosity that some people said, yeah, you know what? Why not? I'll take a look at this reel. And they took a look at the reel, and the reel was pretty good. And we had some good stuff on there. And then slowly but surely, we would get, someone would believe in us and go, I'll give you a shot. And I remember the first job I did that I booked myself, maybe after about a month and a half, was for MTV Asia. And it was for the MTV Europe Music Awards. And we got to do this really cool package, and I'm gonna say, I believe we brought in a young animator designer at the time by the name of Nate Howe. And it was probably, I think, his first job out of college. And he ended up going on to be a superstar and built a great name for himself as well. But it was just fortuitous because he brought a lot of energy to that package, and it really was this cool package. And then I got super excited about that and just used that to springboard my confidence and had a good run with Three Ring, and we did a lot of great stuff. Ended up doing a couple of really cool rebrands. KCET was a rebrand that really stood out to me. We did something for ABC, right, with ABC Worldwide, Wide World of Sports, that was awesome. And so there was just a bunch of sort of firsts for me that were really, really cool. And so probably about 3 years into working at Three Ring, I started hearing about this company, Big Machine. And I had a lot of friends that knew the guys here, Steve Peterson and Ken Carlson. And so I can't remember exactly how we got in touch with each other. They might have heard of me and reached out to me because I think that's what it is. They reached out to me because they were looking for someone to come over and be an executive producer and do business development. And I wasn't necessarily looking to leave Three Ring. I mean, I was actually really, really happy there and happy with my team. But I ended up taking the meeting anyways, and I thought of it more as an obligation to my friends to take the meeting and at least tell these guys, hey, you know, I can tell you a little bit about what I've done to be successful, and maybe I can help you to identify the right person for you guys. So I sat in this conference room with the guys and really liked them, and then liked their staff immensely, and they had some really creative things going on. They did this design meeting every week that was just everyone bringing cool stuff to the table, and I hadn't experienced quite that level of community at Three Ring with what we were doing. And so I was really sort of intrigued with that and intrigued with the creatives here. Well, you know, we sort of danced around each other for a while, and I talked to him about what I think they should be looking for in that position. And then a couple of days later, I said, hey, man, after talking to you, dude, we really don't want to, you know, we want you to come over here. And so they made an offer, and it was generous, and I thought about it for a little bit, and then I said, you know what, maybe it is time to try something new and sort of challenge myself, because that would be a challenge. So there's the fear that you always have when you're leaving one place where you've gotten sort of comfortable. But I always tell people sometimes it's a real good thing. When it gets too comfortable, you should leave, because that means there's the next challenge. And challenge is sort of how you stay hungry and sort of how you prove yourself. And so I just felt, yeah, I'm going to, you know what? I don't think I'm going to fail, because I'm going to believe in myself. I'm going to believe in myself, and I'm going to believe that the potential is there from what I've seen with Big Machine for them to do some really amazing things. So I left. I came over here right away. It was great. It was awesome. We started, you know, booking jobs that were very different from the stuff that Big Machine had been doing. You know, some really big things, NFL game day, redesigning the whole look for that, which was, you know, akin to being a rebrand to some degree. It was a huge job that took all summer, but was really, really awesome. At the time, I think I'd been here maybe 3-4 months, and we did a redesign of the open for at the time Regis and Kelly, and you know, just another fun job, because it, you know, we're in New York City, the beginning of the fall, and we're shooting Regis and Kelly Ripa in the middle of Times Square, and it's like, they're in the trailer, you bring them out to try to get the shot, you know, you have about 2 minutes before mass hysteria ensues, and you got to put them back in. And so just fun stuff like that. A lot of real fun projects over the years. But one of the things that to me has been a real highlight since being at Big Machine, outside of all the cool promos and things of that nature, is we all had a passion to do content. And so we started to think about movies and television, and at the time we were helping out a lot of non-scripted companies to do these sizzle reels that they'd put together in order to sell shows to networks, and they would ask us to do stuff that just was not in their budget to be able to do. But we kind of felt, you know what, we could actually do that stuff for ourselves with our own ideas and go out there and sell our own shows. And so we put a couple of sizzles together, pitched them, you know, by and large, you know, by ourselves, and ended up getting some traction. And we got enough traction that agencies in town started to look at us and pursue us as you know, possibly giving us representation. You know, we landed first at a company called Paradigm, and Cameron Cadison was our agent over there, and awesome guy. And we sold a couple of shows under Cameron's watch. And then he ended up leaving that side of the business. And right around that time, Jad Dia at William Morris came knocking. And that was a great experience. That was really one of the highlights for me, being with William Morris, because it's such a big, iconic company. And I'm a guy that studies industries. So when I was in the music industry, I had read a ton of books on some of the iconic guys. I read Tommy Mottola's biography, and he was running Sony. I read Russell Simmons' biography. And when I became interested in movies and television, I was reading, like David Geffen's biography, Steve Ross, who the original founder of Warner Brothers, Michael Ovitz, the founder of CAA. And so all of a sudden, we're being represented by William Morris, one of the big iconic names out there, and it was really great. We've done some amazing stuff during that run. We produced a short for a Dark Horse property called Number 13, that's still ongoing right now, and is out there in the dealings of Hollywood. But it was great because it got a lot of traction at Comic-Con a couple of years ago, the short that we did. Getting traction at Comic-Con and having William Morris as your agent is not a bad thing in terms of getting meetings and opening doors. So that was sort of a fun ride to be the hot ticket in town for a little while, that every director and every studio was like, oh, we should take a meeting with the Big Machine guys and see, what that Number 13 short is all about. A couple of years ago, we won our first Emmy for a show that we produced called Future Cats for Nat Geo Wild. And that was another highlight. It was another sort of one of those moments where you go, wow. Like the question that you posed to me at the beginning of this, like, how do you go from Howard University to Hollywood and Big Machine? That was one of those moments, the night we won that Emmy, where you're just like, yeah, this has been a crazy journey. And it's still crazy. I mean, the Emmy, when I look at the Emmy sitting out on the desk in our office, it's just like, yeah, I don't know how we got this. I keep waiting for someone to take it away. So yeah, it's just been that sort of a disjointed timeline, but that is sort of Howard to now.
Some of your colleagues and peers have remarked about you being a great businessman. And you said you were at Howard kind of doing marketing and business, and kind of, I guess you were wearing suits and all of this stuff. And people also know you for your ideas and all this stuff. But some serious business people don't also always have these amazing creative ideas. A lot of people who are executive producers in this part of the business, if you look at their resume, for example, it's like producer, associate producer, production coordinator, intern, everything else other than like executive producer, worked in the music business and like worked with Jamie Foxx and lived in New York and like just was working with Bad Boy and just like working with these artists. So you kind of have this interesting thing. And I'm curious, what do you know that we don't?
I don't think I know anything that anyone doesn't. I think that when you remain open to reinventing yourself, that's really the key. When you keep an open mind to possibilities, that's the key. So, from a creative standpoint, I think creativity was always there. And I don't necessarily know that I'm good at creativity, but I think it was always there. I think from being a kid and reading comic books and basically just being a geek, I always tell people, especially here at Big Machine, because we're all sort of geeks, I go, yeah, I was just sort of this weird, I've always been this weird hybrid, right? So when I was growing up, I was a video game playing comic book geek, and probably still am. But physically, I was developing a very athletic body. And so I played sports and, lacrosse and football and excelled at a lot of the sports I was playing. But I was still a nerd. So I was like friends with the jocks because I was a jock. But I was also friends with the nerds, and to some degree at times where I was even protecting the nerds. Like, hey, if you beat them up, you got to deal with me. And so it's interesting because I think creativity has just always been there. Business just became my fascination. I just I I you know, I distinctly remember when I was younger watching my dad, who was an engineer, but I would watch him talk business, and it just had an influence on me, like just, you know, it's cool to be talking business. I don't know what they're talking, but I want to be talking business, you know? So I think that those two things were just in me. As I've gotten older, it's become more pointed in terms of, you know, always expanding your mind from a creative standpoint, always exposing yourself to stuff that can keep you hungry, keep you on the edge of knowing what's out there. And business just, you know, you get to a point, at the risk of sounding like an old man, but you just get to the point where the things that you know business-wise and the experience you've amassed from having successes but making mistakes, just make it so that you just know, you know. And I joke with people. I go, no, you know, if I knew the stuff now that I know in my 40s when I was in my 20s, I mean, I could be a billionaire, and I'm sure everyone feels like that. But it really is true. You just, something happens after 40 where the light just clicks and you're like, oh yeah, I've seen that before. Yeah, I know how to do that deal. I've seen that contract before. I know what this feels like in terms of how this business venture is heading, and so I know sort of how to react to that. It's just there, you know. And it's you know, to me, one of the few perks of getting older, because physically there's not that many perks, but the mind, yes, the wisdom, right?
I was listening to an interview with Byron Allen, who is the founder of Entertainment Studios. And one thing that he talked, very controversial figure. One thing he talked about, though, was kind of something similar to what you just said. And well, what seems to be a sort of thorough line in your story, which is understanding the business and kind of understanding the numbers. And he talked about, you know, he looked at the budget like that Comcast had for that they spend with affiliate networks and all this stuff. And he was like, you know, I think that we could provide value in that space, so we deserve a chunk of that stuff. Does noticing these numbers and knowing the numbers and knowing the finances and knowing and providing value, and like, how important has that information been to your success? And do you talk and present with the numbers in mind?
I do. For me especially, you know, Big Machine's been great because everyone's got sort of their role. You know, my partner Steve is a great director and he's got his vision, and my other partner Ken Carlson is great with effects and sort of understanding, you know, some of the technical workflows that have to happen behind creativity. And I'm really good at numbers and sort of understanding maybe how a deal should be structured and sort of having experience in that lane. So I think when you have to combine all three, because if you just go in with numbers, a lot of times you end up with not the best creative. And that's across the board. That's whether it's a promo, a commercial, a television show, or a feature film. Usually the failures in all of the mediums I just mentioned have to do with it just being a numbers decision without anyone going, well, was this any good? You know, like, was the creative any good? You know, I mean, it might have made sense just number-wise or, you know, and in some ways, it can reverse itself. Sometimes maybe something doesn't make sense number-wise, but if you'd really paid attention to the creative, it made sense, right? And so you have that, too. You have those movies that are outliers, and you go, wow, well, everyone passed on this because of the numbers, but there was the one guy that saw Memento and said, boy, this Chris Nolan guy might have a future here. Yeah, let me bankroll that, you know? So, or Stranger Things, you know, to me, it's crazy when you listen to those guys' stories. It's like, wow, they had a lot of people passing that. And it's like, well, how did you look at this and pass on this? You know, I mean, this definitely seemed like it was a hit idea. So, yeah, I think it works both ways. But I think you have to be aware of the numbers, but you have to be aware of the numbers in context with creative. So I always match my numbers to what the creative is. So, and to me, that's the plan for success. For at least my plan for success has been matching both, as opposed to one being more important than the other.
You kind of understanding going from Howard to sort of the music business, it seemed like your relationships and your networking really played a big part in those transitions. Even going to like Beverly Hills and the penthouse with your friend, and you know, you kind of knew him, and you like, okay, let's work together. Until one day you just went on the job board and kind of found, right. you know. So, but how important has networking and relationships and contacts and maintaining those relationships, and how important has that been for you? And what's the secret to maintaining that?
It's definitely very important. Networking is always going to be important. It's how things get done. Relationships are how things get done. I think part of it is very, very genuine, and part of it is something you have to work at. So the part that's very genuine is when I think about my friend Mike and he's still producing and we're still talking about doing stuff together, and we talk a lot about, you know, where he's at now, where I'm at now, and fortunately I think I've had some successes now that will allow me to sort of create some opportunities for him, where it's like, hey, maybe I got something you can do music on, and like let's develop that, and then let's walk through some of these doors of people that we know together, and figure out some opportunities. So that's a natural one because the friendship is there. I think the challenge that a lot of people have is when you're looking at something from a business standpoint and going, I got to make some contacts here. Well, really, in order for you to be successful in whatever business endeavor, those contacts and those connections you need to make, they need to like you. You need to like them. And it needs to be genuine. And so what I try to do, and you know, people always ask me like, "Oh yeah, it just seems like you know a lot of people, and a lot of people know you at Pro Max, and how do you do that?" And I said, "I just make friends. I mean, it's not, but it's what I try to do. A lot of people try to go, I'm trying to get someone to give me a project or give me a gig. I tell people, you know, there are people that I talk to that I haven't worked with this year." That I really consider friends, that I really like. You know, I have Carla Danix at Nat Geo is someone that I regularly try to stay in touch with. I don't think Carla and I have done a project this year, but you know, genuinely, I like her. You know, and I always go, there's always something that you have in common with everybody, and I just like to meet people and like to talk to them and like to find that common connector. I'm a huge sports fanatic, so a lot of times it's really easy for me because inevitably if I start talking about the NFL or some other sport, that's usually a connector with people. But I'm also sort of like a pop culture aficionado. So, comics, movies, music, very diverse musical taste. I mean, I worked primarily in hip-hop and R&B, but, you know, when you work at major record labels, you sort of learn to love all the music departments. So I like some country. I like some, you know, punk rock. I like some, they like a ton of rock, like a ton of alternative. So there's always a connector that you can find. And if you just find that connector and talk to someone, I think good things happen because people usually want to work with people that they like, that there's a connection with.
We did an interview last year where I believe maybe the title was How Design Can Influence a Movement. And we talked about Black Lives Matter originally, but kind of looked at like the Hope Barack Obama symbol. And we looked at the peace symbol and a lot of symbols throughout history and how they influenced and they influenced that moment. And they captured that moment. And we look at those symbols as things. And we talked about, well, what's the symbol for what's going on right now? And I think before we started, we kind of talked about like, maybe there's a new edge on that. Maybe there's a new look at that.
Yeah. It's interesting because we're coming up on a year since you and I had that conversation. And I felt really strongly about it then with everything that was going on with police and police brutality. And then with what happened in the election in November, my radar was up even more. And then sort of you fast forward to where we are exactly right now in this specific point in time with Charlottesville and some of the things being said out there. And it does. It seems like it's more prevalent. It seems like more than ever we all need to remember that we're all in this together, you know. But we can talk about it. This country, whether we like it or not, it has a diversity and a race problem, you know, and it's not necessarily a black and white problem. I think it's just a diversity problem in general. And obviously there's a voice out there that sort of wants to keep it divided. And I just think we need to figure out a symbol and a language and a visual language that just reminds us that we are much stronger together, all together, than we are divided. And realizing that, you know, people are, there are people out there that are just as scared of a black movement, and then there's people that are scared of a white movement. But also realize that there are a ton of people, and unfortunately some of these people are people with a voice and with power, who are scared of a movement to have everyone be together, a black and white movement, if so to speak. So, you know, we're going to figure that out. We're going to figure out what that visual language is. But yeah, I think since we've talked, it's become more than police brutality. It's become, there's a ton of issues out there. There's, you know, immigration issues. So I think it's really become a people issue. It's become a human condition of us just needing to get along better as individuals, black, white, Latino, Asian. Just, we're all in this together, you know. So.
Cool. I think my last question is around this idea of, you've had a lovely career up to this point, at least when I look on paper and when I hear your story. And when you're thinking about somebody who's an up and comer in this business, what's like the number one thing that you would want to say to them? And as they may be dealing with change or transformation or stagnation or even happiness, you know, what's something that you have to say?
Well, there's a lot of people that'll tell you sort of the cliches, and they tell you that because some of those cliches are correct. You know, never give up, stay focused. That's all good stuff. I think what I would tell somebody is just realize, when you're at your lowest point, that the sun is going to come out tomorrow. And whether you like it or not, you have to keep going and you will survive. And I say that because that's something that I've always lived by. Like when I've had low points, my motto was always like, well, you know, I got to keep going. I mean, what else am I going to do? Just lay down here and die, which is something my uncle used to say to me. But it's so true. It's like, well, I have two choices at this point. I mean, I lay down and die, and I'm not going to do that. So I'll have to put my shoes on again tomorrow and figure it out. And I think that when you have that, it's amazing how that hour of despair may turn into a day of despair. But then there's another day that comes after that, and another day. And then eventually the despair goes away, and eventually a moment comes up where you recognize that moment, go, oh, this is a moment for me to pull myself out of that challenge and change direction or climb up out of the problem. And it always happens. And it happens for everyone. And the only time it's a failure is when people just fail to realize that you have those two choices and just choose to keep going. And sometimes people just choose to let the despair swallow them up or let the situation swallow them up. And then that dictates their actions. And that's sad.
A big shout out to the sponsors of this episode, our friends at 2C Creative. If you're looking for an award-winning agency to handle all of your creative needs, from 360 integrations to live action, design, trailers, and editorial, head to www.2c.tv. Paige Albiniak is editorial director of Promax BDA. LaFern Cusack is executive producer of the Daily Brief podcast and senior producer at Promax BDA. Video helper provided the music. Digital producer Kate Lekeyer-Marion and social media coordinator Kristen Craik contribute to Daily Brief. Follow Paige on Twitter at Paige A. Follow LaFern at LaFern Cusack. Follow Promax BDA at Promax BDA. You can reach out to us at dailybrief@promaxbda.org. Subscribe to the Daily Brief podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.